And I'll read the whole chapter, James 3, 1 through 18. My brethren, be not many masters, knowing that we shall receive the greater condemnation. For in many things we offend all, and if any man offend not in word, the same is a perfect man, and able also to bridle the whole body. Behold, we put bits in the horses' mouths, that they may obey us, and we turn about the whole body. Behold also the ships, which though they be so great, and are driven by fierce winds, yet are they turned about with a very small helm, whithersoever the governor listeth. Even so the tongue is a little member, and boasteth great things. Behold how great a matter a little fire kindleth. And the tongue is a fire, a world of iniquity. So is the tongue among our members, that it defileth the whole body, and setteth on fire the course of nature, and is set on fire of hell. For every kind of beast, and of birds, and of serpents, and of things in the sea is tamed, and hath been tamed of mankind. But the tongue can no man tame. It is an unruly evil, full of deadly poison. Therewith bless we God, even the Father, and therewith curse we men, which are made after the similitude of God. Out of the same mouth proceedeth blessing and cursing. My brethren, these things ought not to be so. Doth the fountain send forth at the same place sweet water and bitter? Can the fig tree, my brethren, bear olive berries, either a vine figs? So can no fountain both yield salt water and fresh. Who is a wise man and endued with knowledge among you? Let him show out of a good conversation his works with meekness of wisdom. But if ye have bitter envying and strife in your hearts, glory not and lie not against the truth. This wisdom descendeth not from above, but is earthly, sensual, devilish. For where envying and strife is, there is confusion and every evil work. But the wisdom that is from above is first pure, then peaceable, gentle, and easy to be entreated, full of mercy and good fruits, without partiality and without hypocrisy. The fruit of righteousness is sown in peace of them that make peace. Thus ends the reading of God's holy, inspired word. As Lord's Day morning, we return again to a series of lectures on parenting by God's promises, having looked at two of the four sections of the book, having considered covenantal foundations for parenting, and then having considered parenting as prophets, priests, and kings. We've been looking for a number of weeks at this third section, practical steps for childbearing. Considered some guidance from our Puritan forefathers. We've considered how to teach or to nurture our children relative to piety. Two weeks ago, we looked at teaching children how to listen. And then this week, we'll seek to talk concerning how to tame children's tongues. Next week, Lord willing, we'll look at sibling relationships. And then we'll move into the last section, Lord willing, practical help for teenagers. But this morning, we'll consider taming children's tongues. In this chapter, Dr. Beeke begins with the discussion relative to the gift of speech. God speaks. He's given us as those created in His image the ability to understand His speech, to be able to speak ourselves, and to be able to communicate with one another. Then he moves into speaking about some basic principles out of this section that we've just read in chapter 3 of James 3. And he says the tongue, or tongues are five these. They're destructive. He mentions that James says the tongue is a fire. And fires here clearly are destructive. That's the focus. He says they're defiling. In verse 6 he says they're a world of iniquity. So iniquity is all about them. And it's a full world, a big iniquity, all types of iniquity. He also goes on to say, it says the tongue is devilish. it's set on fire, he says, of hell. So tongue sins begin ultimately with Satan. And Satan was a father of lies from the beginning. And then he also goes on to say that the tongue is defiant. And looking at verses 7 and 8, it cannot be tamed. Obviously, James is thinking here, can't be tamed apart from the grace of God. We could say, cannot be perfectly tamed in this life. And then he goes on to say, it's also deadly. The tongue is full of deadly poison. So 5 D's that we need to remember about the tongue. The tongue's destructive, it's defiling, it's devilish, it's defiant, and it's deadly. Then Dr. Beakey talks about some wrongful speech to avoid before he talks about some positive ways to use our tongues for God's glory. So just as in all of Christian living, there are things that we need to put off as well as things that we need to put on. So in dealing with our tongues, there's things that we need to not do, we're called not to do, and then there are also things we're called to do. Some of the wrongful speech that he suggests to avoid is judgmental or critical words. There he quotes Psalm 10:7. Here is a portrait of the ungodly man. His mouth is full of cursing and deceit and fraud. Under his tongue is mischief and vanity. So his mouth is full of cursing, deceit, and fraud. 3 forms of sins of the tongue. And then he says, under the tongue, or what's the motivation of some of these sins is mischief and vanity, or the intent to stir something up, to create some trouble, mischief and vanity, some attempt to propagandize or to make something look different than it is. Something that is vain is hollow. So it's seeking to make something of nothing, or to make something look like something that it's not. And so we're told that cursing, deceit, and fraud are the kind of things that would be utilized to create mischief or to promote some false view. He then goes on to talk about other wrongful speech, profanity, obscenity, and vulgarity. Here he doesn't quote any passages of Scripture in that little section, but as I thought about it, I thought maybe it would be appropriate to consider Ephesians 4:29. There Paul says, let no corrupt communication proceed out of your mouth. It's all forms of communication or words that corrupt. And so let none of those kind of words that corrupt others' hearts be spoken. What we're informed is what people hear do affect the very inner part of their being. They imbibe them, they can take them on, and then they corrupt them, pollute them. So, no judgmental or critical words, no profanity, obscenity, or vulgarity. And then he also speaks of outbursts of anger. He quotes Ephesians 4:26, "Be ye angry and sin not." So he says there's a place for anger, but not sinful anger. Too often we try to justify our anger by suggesting it's righteous, when I contend most of the time it's probably very unrighteous. But at the same time, I'm not prepared, although I have a dear friend who says there's no such thing as in a sinful person righteous anger. And I think in some sense that's correct, because there's always some pollution. But we do know that Jesus, the perfect man, was angry and sinned not. We're told when he asked the Pharisees why he couldn't heal a man on the Sabbath day, and they wouldn't give him an answer. It says he looked about them with anger. He was very angry that they didn't care enough about people and had so added to the Word of God relative to the Sabbath, something that Jesus still maintained, but they had added their own rules about it such that they were unable to help people in need on the Sabbath because they viewed it as a work, though God didn't. Jesus was angry. So we can be angry, but we can't sin in that anger. And quite often, when we do sin in that anger, it does express itself not only in our countenance, but in our words. James 1:19, let every man be swift to hear, we looked at this 2 weeks ago, slow to speak, slow to wrath. And so quite often, our quickness to speech is related to our short fuse. And we get ticked off, and then we say things that are in haste and are inappropriate and are sinful and demonstrate anger or wrath. And wrath is actually a deeper anger. Wrath is kind of a settled anger. And so James says we not only need to be slow to anger, but we need to be slow to that settled anger, that settled disposition. We have a chip on our shoulder, and we're looking for a fight, looking to be contentious. And that kind of rolls into the fourth type of speech that Dr. Beeke says we ought to seek to avoid, and that is nagging, murmuring, and complaining. Now, clearly, Dr. Beeke is not trying to cover all the sins of the tongue in this chapter or in this section of the chapter, but he's just trying to give us an overview of some particular sins of the tongue that can be very detrimental in the family. When he talks about nagging, murmuring, and complaining, he reminds us that in Psalm 95, 8 through 11, we're told about that period of contention or provocation amongst the people of God in the wilderness. We're told that that complaining spirit, that complaining disposition of the people of Israel in general was part of the reason they were kept out of the Promised Land for 40 years. So consider the blessings that aren't ours because of our complaining relative to what we do have. And God keeps things from us because we're not happy with what we have. That's the whole point of Psalm 95, 8 through 10. But consider also Proverbs 27, 15. A continual dropping in a very rainy day. Solomon's going to compare a continual dropping in a very rainy day. Now, some of you may have experienced a hole in your roof before, or a hole in some roof somewhere, right? And you got a pot sitting there, tick, 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 dripping all day long. Well, in antiquity, obviously, people didn't have as good a roofs and couldn't get a roofer to come and fix the roof perfectly. A lot of the roofs were thatched, and if it rained long enough, eventually, water would start dripping through that thatch. And it says a continual dropping in a very rainy day. That can be kind of annoying, can it? And the contentious woman are alike. So Solomon says there were people, not just women, but men too, who are contentious. They're looking for a fight. They're always finding something to complain about. He says they can be as annoying as that drop in the bucket or in the pan over and over and over again. So these are some of the forms or patterns of speech that we need to seek to avoid. Then he talks about using our tongue for God's glory. He says in that section we need to remind ourselves what we deserve. Because oftentimes our tongues are complaining. And so if we remember God's mercy, and that God has given us much more than, much better than we deserve, then that certainly helps us relative to complaining. He also encourages us to speak positively to our spouses and to our children. And what I thought was helpful there is if you consider Proverbs 31:28. Proverbs 31:28, speaking of the virtuous woman, It says there, her children arise up and call her blessed, her husband also, and he praiseth her. Here's a picture of the morning and mom doing her duty, serving her children and her husband, and both her children and her husband are commending her for her labors for them. They're very thankful. And I think we should understand, though the children's first here in the verse, I think we should understand that it's likely the children have learned from dad this pattern of being thankful, not the other way around. So, commendation. We clearly see that in Revelation 2 and 3. Jesus commends the churches as well as critiques the churches there in Asia. And it's easy to focus on the things that we're not doing in such a way as to not be helpful. I think even heathen are starting to get that in a new wave in management literature and leadership literature. There's a whole a wave of literature. I think Gallup is involved in a lot of the publications. It's stressing, focusing on your strengths as an individual or as a company rather than your weaknesses. Well, I think that might be an overreaction, but I think the point is, as an individual, as a company, you have strengths and weaknesses, but if you're always focused on trying to build up your weaknesses and fix your weaknesses, you may not be promoting a full health. You need to recognize where you're strong. You also need to utilize your strengths. And isn't that true in really any endeavor in life? If you don't use your strengths, you're probably not going to be as successful in whatever that endeavor is. Yeah, you need to bolster your weaknesses and solve those, but don't forget what you're good at. Don't stop doing what you're good at. So I think that relates. We need to commend our children. We need to commend one another in our families. And then he also suggests we should be cheerful. Proverbs 15:13 says, "A merry heart maketh a cheerful countenance." Now this word merry in the Hebrew is a very, very broad word. It can mean sound, it can mean whole, full, organized. And the whole point is it's a heart that's right, that's correct, that's seeing things and believing things as they really are, living in reality. That makes a cheerful countenance. So we're told is that how we are in the inner person is most often reflected in our expressions. And mainly the vehicle, predominantly the portion of our anatomy that we make those expressions mostly is in our face. It can be by our posture and things at some level, but predominantly in the face, their eyes, significantly. Be cheerful, he says. Consider also Romans 12:8. The one who shows mercy or has the gift and he exercises that gift of mercy, Paul says, ought to do so with cheerfulness. So to exercise mercy takes a degree of self-denial. To exercise mercy requires us to say no to certain things that we might enjoy doing so that we can help someone else that's in need. And the one that shows mercy has a different evaluation than most people. They recognize that they really find much more satisfaction in helping somebody that's needing than they do in just doing what they want to do. And so eventually what they want to do is actually help people because it glorifies God, but they also find delight in it. So we should show mercy with cheerfulness. Any comments or thoughts thus far? The 5 D's of controlling our tongues, 4 things we ought to avoid: judgmental or critical words, profanity, obscenity, and vulgarity, outburst of anger, nagging, murmuring, complaining. And then the four positives, reminding ourselves of what we deserve, speaking positively to our spouses, speaking positively to our children, and being cheerful. Any thoughts, comments, questions? What hits you? Process. That's what this reminds you. I think it's the kind of thing that kind of ebbs and flows too. You may have some teaching on it. We as a congregation had some teaching on it years ago, but it's been a long time. Kind of like it's, but it's so relevant because it's, I just think it's a common cultural sin. I think if you consider, is it Leviticus 18 or 19? I think the Puritans viewed sanctification as basically two aspects, dying to sin and living unto righteousness. And that's part of what the catechism question suggests. So it's dying to sin, which is often self, right? But it's also extinguishing the fiery darts of Satan. So it's not always from our own, right? But it's putting the death sin and putting on righteousness. I think Paul in Ephesians and Colossians uses that metaphor in both of those chapters. It's like taking off the dirty clothes and putting on clean clothes. So, and I think Jay Adams does a good job of suggesting that that is tied uniquely to habits. That we do develop patterns of behavior, certain responses, certain initiative, you know, certain initiators, and eventually that's the habit we have. And so it's not just knowing that I'm not supposed to do that when that happens. It's actually having to focus a significant degree of attention and prayer and meditation upon that issue for a period of time, and to actually not do that for several weeks. One illustration I always think is helpful that Dr. Adams brings out is that he says men either button their shirts from the top down or the down up. And you don't do it both ways. You don't one morning do it one way and one morning the next morning the other way. And I don't know which way I do it. But you do. But if you wanted to change that, you couldn't just tomorrow morning say, I'm going to change the way I button my shirt. And it'd be done. It would take, he says, at least almost 30 days of doing it a different way before you'll do it that different way without thinking about it anymore. And so I think he's right on that point. I think the tongue, obviously, is one of the Ten Commandments, is clearly connected to the tongue. I think Dr. Beakey mentions three of the six things that, six or seven that are an abomination in the Proverbs 6, or connected to the tongue. And it's Leviticus 19:16. Thou shalt not go up and down as a talebearer among thy people, neither shalt thou stand against the blood of thy neighbor. I am the Lord. Thou shalt not hate thy brother in thy heart. Thou shalt in any wise rebuke thy neighbor and not suffer a sin upon him. Thou shalt not avenge, nor bear any grudge against the children of thy people, but thou shalt love thy neighbor as thyself. I am the Lord. Here's this passage about gossip, about going up and down, but in the context, he speaks about there being no unrighteous judgment or respecters of persons. but righteousness, in righteousness should you judge your neighbor. And then it follows immediately upon this, don't go door to door. And I think the whole thought is, you know, if you don't have righteousness, if you're not willing to deal with issues in the public arena, under oath or under a certain degree of scrutiny so that people can see what's there, then you really promote some level of communication that goes on under the underground. But that if righteousness is dealt with and there's judgment and equity, then these things can be dealt with. We're going to look at a pretty gruesome thing that a man did. A Levite cut up his wife who had been abused and cuts her up into 12 pieces and sends them out to the tribes. And you think, man, that is just, that is horrible. He shouldn't have done it. I think Matthew Henry, a number of commentators, said that's one thing he should have done. He should have been willing to die to the death to not have his wife or concubine, his live-in wife, his common, common law marriage wife, potentially, abused. But having done that, the fact that there was no king in Israel, there was no judge in Israel, every man did what was right in his own eyes, he really didn't have a court system to go to. And so he wanted everybody to know so that they might come together, even though they weren't organized and ready to come together to deal with it immediately. He did something to let them all know what's going on so that maybe they would get their act together and deal with the culprits. So I think that's kind of what it suggests is if you're dealing with it upright and forthrightly in the public arena, the way I look at it is fighting fair, fighting by the rules, and contending by the rules, so to speak. As Jay Adams says, there is going to be contention. There's a certain degree of scriptural principles that say we do have to reprove, rebuke. There are things that do lead to conflict, but the Bible tells us how to resolve that conflict.
A spring of water does not put out salt and sweet water.
Yeah, it's right here in James 3.
Okay, good.
Yeah.
But it has to come honestly and completely from within.
Well, I think that follows the principle of Proverbs 4:23, keep your heart with all diligence, for out of it are the issues of life. I think Jesus, when he speaks of out of the heart, cometh forth these things, he is saying that you have to ultimately cultivate your attitude, your disposition, your heart. The inner man, who you are, does reflect how you act. And so you're right. I mean, it's not just actions, it's heart cultivation. And I think that's why Dr. Adams suggests it's meditation and prayer that has to precede these efforts to change our sinful habits, to stop reacting to something that. Right.
I will never see these things, habits and things of that nature. It has to come from above.
Right.
The Holy Spirit is the one that feeds us.
Well, that's Psalm 19, and it. The end of Psalm 19. The psalm that David says, who can understand his errors? He's kind of acknowledging, I wouldn't be to see my sins. Cleanse thou me from my secret faults or secret sins, my secrets. He's saying, I don't think he's saying cleanse me without me knowing about it. I think he's saying, let me, you know, help me know about it so I can, so we can get this right. But I don't know about it by myself. I'm going to need your help to know about it. And in Psalm 141, David says that he really appreciates the person that reproves him, and that even if that person finds themselves in trouble, he's still going to be praying for their welfare. He's not going to develop a bitterness or a wrath against them. Right. Right. Work out your salvation. Well, I think it's with fear and trembling, for it is God that is work in you, both to will and to work. If it wasn't God's grace, we wouldn't want to do good things. And we wouldn't have the ability to do good works. Good. He then talks about helping our children control their tongues. He focuses on setting an example, obviously. But then he also says we can nurture contentment in gratitude, and then he does give some case studies in controlling the tongue. He gives three areas that are probably common issues in homes. Children being disrespectful to mom, children telling lies, or children teasing one another, picking on one another. And his solutions are pretty basic there. Nothing real shocking, but I thought his comments on 2:15, as he dealt with edifying speech, were helpful. He says, we gain nothing by confronting children in an adversarial manner. All that does is teach them to put up defenses. Our children are trying to establish their own identities, and they desperately need approval. So it is vitally important that when we correct them, they also know that we love them, appreciate them, and are aiming at their well-being. So he says there's a positive spin that you can put on a negative encounter, engagement, so to speak, verbally. And I would argue that in the world that we live in, as worldly as it is and as worldly as the church is, we could say that our culture is extremely immature. That is, that most of us haven't grown up. And so we think our children are trying to establish their own identities and desperately need approval. Well, there's tons of people in their 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, 70s that are still trying to find their own identities and are desperately looking for approval. And that's the reality of our culture. It's very immature. We don't understand the basics. And our culture has become a very youth-oriented culture, hasn't it? And so even the aged are trying to be young again. And then he also, as he talks about an example, or at this point he's talking about the last, it's really the closing, the very closing of this chapter, using our tongue to serve Christ. He says on page 220, we should set Christ before our families as an example. We need to say to our families, Jesus Christ never spoke one wrong word. We are all sinners. Let us go to Jesus Christ and ask Him to help us by His Spirit to tame our tongues. Let us seek grace to love as Christ loved, speak as Christ spoke, and walk as Christ walked. So, I think quite often in the whole sanctification picture, whether it's dealing with sins of the tongue or other sins, you do have to get down to the particular issues, the sins that need to be avoided, the sins that or the righteous habits that need to be put on. But you've got to return from that to the motive and to the example. The example is Jesus Christ. And the assistance comes from the Spirit via prayer that must go to the Father through Jesus Christ. So, again, if you don't go there, it's just behaviorism. We're just trying to, self-help. There are plenty of good self-help books out there, but ultimately, if they don't focus on Christ, people can only make a modicum of the degree of improvement. If some people broken the habit of drunkenness through the 12 steps of AA, yes. But it's not the best method because it doesn't involve grace. And that's what we so desperately need. And even any calls for grace or whatever can't be obtained but through Jesus Christ. And so even in some of those things, there's this attempt to go to some higher power for help. But God is not a higher power that we can tap into any way we choose to. We can only get to Him through the Son. Any other thoughts or comments? We'll maybe ask a few questions. Question one was, speech is an incredible blessing, but how can it serve as a curse in our fallen world? Speech is a blessing, but how is it a curse? I saw a little something on the internet this weekend, at least on one of my emails. You always get kind of like the headlines, and sometimes I just look through those and occasionally click on one. And there was a story about a girl in British Columbia who had been picked on and brutalized just with words and mainly through cell phone and other, you know, social media things by her classmates, and she put up something on the internet where she didn't speak but just had cards that said things. You know, she's kind of standing back in the shadows. That was out there on the internet for a while. School officials actually knew about it. She said she was going to take her life in that thing, and eventually she did. And then they're interviewing girls in her from her class, and they're all saying this was going on for years, and they didn't know, you know, if it was her, if it was them, they would have probably killed themselves much earlier than she did. This, I mean, this is rampant. The people destroying one another and just tearing one another down with their words. And with so much insecurity and just picking on somebody, just finding somebody that's weak. And that went on in our day. But I think with the social media and the more avenues of in our day, you could only be picked on while you were there at school for so many hours, but it's hard to pick on you at home when you're at home. But if you're on Facebook or Twitter or this or that, I mean, you could just be getting barraged. And parents not know. The parents be out of touch or choose to be out of touch. So definitely a curse. It was Satan's tongue that led Adam and Eve to have a different view of the way things really were. They acted on that view. And now we've been distorting things and hurting one another in that distortion ever since. Two, what should we teach our children from James 3 about the use of their tongues? It's destructive. It's poisonous. Or it's deadly. Five, how should we respond to outbursts of anger in our families, from ourselves, our spouses, and our children? How should we respond to outbursts of anger? What's the Scripture say about that? Just give me one thing we ought to do. Just a couple. Okay. I guess he's suggesting once we have, what do we do then? How do we pick up the pieces? Excuse me? Privately consult rather than, right? Okay. And then Usually if it's done privately, then maybe there's less anger, or maybe it takes a little bit of time to get alone. And then we could prepare our hearts when we are alone with the person that did something that angered us. But often isn't anger relative to someone's behavior often connected to either a control issue, that I want everything just the way I want it. And I want to be like God and control, ultimately be in control of everybody's behavior except for mine. That would be righteous anger, right? But how often the control issue, or I would say the embarrassment issue, becomes a significant element of the whole matter. If they had done it in private, or they had done it just in front of me, but if they had done it in front of the crowd, or, you know, then it reflects negatively on them, but it reflects negatively on me. So therefore, right. Right. Rather than recognize our response reflects more upon us, as most people do have a sense that we all sin, and it's really how we handle those things that kind of indicates one's character a lot more than the actual thing coming up. And again, this gets down to camouflage and false Christian fruit. You can establish a pattern in your home that minimizes exposure by other people, and you can so promote a non-vulnerability method that keeps you out of touch with people and keeps you from people from being exposed to the inner workings of your family. But does that really promote godliness? Or does James say, hey, we're supposed to confess our sins to one another? And I think in that passage, James isn't saying, I got to tell you when I sinned against you. It's actually saying, we're getting close enough where I can tell you where I'm weak for my good, so you can be praying for me, so you can take an interest in how much of that goes on. Because again, we live in a very competitive society, a very superficial society. Also, all the social media, but we really, all these people that have so many friends on Facebook, how many true friends they really have. It's almost just the opposite. The more friends you have on Facebook, the less true friends you have. It's an inverse relationship. So, good. How should we respond to a murmuring spirit in our children? Right, so consider first yourself. You have a mote in your own eye, or a beam in your own eye, you're trying to get the mote out. I always like that principle. You shouldn't be doing eye surgery if you've got something in your own eye yourself, right? If you're going to try to help get something out of somebody else's eye, you don't need any grit in your contact lenses while you're trying to do it, and have some blurriness while you're trying to do that. It's a pretty exacting operation. Takes care. Good. I think also it's related to, we are called to discern. So we are called to be able to see when things aren't right. But then the question is, people that are observant and think deeply and connect dots and see patterns and things that are emerging in a family, in their own family, in an organization, the church, their own company, how do they live in light of the things that they know that aren't right? And some people are better at seeing those things than others. Some people choose to be oblivious. Some people just are, by temperament, more oblivious than others. But how do you deal with that? I don't think it's blow it off. I don't think it's ignore it. But at the same time, I think it's dealing with the recognition that there's sin and everything. There's the multitude of sins, and that we don't have our lives exactly in order. We don't always communicate clearly
We do all these things, and so we're going to realize we live in a fallen world.
Yeah, he spoke his word. And the false prophets chose to speak their own words. And I think at that level we are. I mean, I think the book of Revelation, in a significant way, is the consummation of the prophecies in Scripture. In chapter 11, we'll see some examples connected or some similarities with Ezekiel. And we've already seen some with Jeremiah. These men were basically told to speak to a nation that was falling away. They weren't going to see what we would call positive fruit. They weren't going to see revivals from their ministries. But God still told them, this is what you've got to speak. And I'll be glorified in your speaking, and I'll be glorified in the hardness of the people that hear it, nonetheless. And that's something we have to recognize in church history. There's ebbs and flows. There's preachers that are in revival seasons. There's preachers that aren't. There's places in the world where things are flourishing. There's places in the world where the church is dying, or apparently dying. But praise be to God, it never truly dies.